kids, it's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. We got a lot to take care of today. Let's not beat around the bush. Let's not dilly-dally. Let's dive right into things. Pernell Vaughn, you're here. How are you doing?
I'm hungry and cold and tired. How are you?
Holy shit, that was loud.
I get excited.
How's things going? How was your weekend?
It was actually very nice. We had that Baco preview of spring. It was like nice 80 degree day. So I spent it eating water ice and walking around downtown Newark, and then played some board games at a friend's house. Oh, and had ramen, because ramen's good.
Ooh, and you played video games, right?
A little.
I would hope you played a little, because you got something to talk about today.
Oh, shit. That was what I was supposed to do. Oh, man.
Well, I mean, that's why you come on my show.
This is Trouble World. I thought I was here to tell you about how nice it was on Saturday.
How nice was it on Saturday?
So good. So nice. You could see through the past the clouds. It was bright and shit. Deer were eating from the garbage. It was that good. It was that good. I can't begin. There was no snow on the ground, which means you could see all the pollution and litter.
It was
great.
I swear, it feels like for 2 months straight now, we've just been talking about the fucking awful, crazy weather every time you're on.
It's like we bring the small talk of the world to a podcast.
How's the weather? Oh my God, don't even get me fucking started on it.
Don't get me started on that weather there. It's terrible, I tell you, man. And the missus, she's always like, what's with the snow? When you're going to shovel the walkway? And I'm like, I'm tired, babe. I got home from work.
Well, instead of chatting about weather, let's chat about games. What do you think?
That's good. Let's do it. Let's talk about Weather Simulator 2018.
Okay, so first game to talk about is called Weather Simulator. that would suck so bad if we just went from weather talk right to a weather video game. But first real game to talk about tonight is called Streets of Red Devil's Dare Deluxe, developed and published by Secret Base. It released April 12th on the Switch and PS4 for $8.99. In Streets of Red Devil's Dare Deluxe, the only thing scarier than being eaten alive is running out of quarters. A permadeath multiplayer horror beat-em-up that bestows players with the skills of retro gaming heroes in a fight against a legion of undead monstrosities. Pernell, tell me about this one.
First thing to point out, if anyone's actually seen screen images of this game, one thing I've noticed people like to make comments about is that it's like a knockoff or ripoff of famous game properties. To that I say, that's bullshit. It's actually an homage to famous game properties, which is an okay thing to have. So the intent is that you are at a makeshift Penny Arcade Expo. They call it like Benny Arcade or something like that expo. And for no reason whatsoever, or explain the reason, a zombie outbreak occurs. The undead go nuts and crazy monsters run a rampant. And your four main characters that you can choose from are offered in a deal by a red fairy, which bestows upon them powers based off of video game type properties. You have one character who is essentially Terra in Magitek armor from Final Fantasy VI. You have a knight who I think is kind of funny because in the original version, which was on Steam back in the day, it was the dwarf from Golden Axe, but he is now Shovel Knight. So it's like, okay, whatever. And there's a little kid who becomes a ninja and another guy who kind of becomes like a Link-esque character. So the way the game works is that it's a side-scrolling beat-em-up where you go from left to right and sometimes right to left, punching some more various enemies that show up on the screen. You have a basic hit combo, and you have three special attacks per character that range between typically a ranged attack, a close range get out of jail free card move, and just like a really powerful attack. And then there is something called the extra joy, which you can press two buttons together and it will push people away from you. And when you use that attack, it'll pretty much burn out your entire special meter, and it goes into an overheat, which has like a cooldown before you can start using special moves again. So what's cool about this game, I think, is that the way they designed it was the developers intended for it to be more like a throwback to when you had to actually get through a game on one credit, not one credit quiz, but pretty much on like a dollar, so to speak. So what they do is you start the game, you have one life. And as you beat enemies up, you collect money. And you only really get money from killing enemies with special attacks. So that's an interesting thing. You want to finish enemies with specials to get money. And if you finish groups of enemies off with the same special attack, you'll do something called like a masker combo, which yields you healing food. So you take the money that you get, and when you die, the game will charge you money to resurrect yourself, just as if you were putting a quarter into an arcade machine.
That's a cool mechanic.
It's awesome. And here's the thing. If you can't revive, it not only ends your game, but it erases your save file, too.
Oh, shit.
Yep. So it sounds worse than it actually is. I mean, because, again, it's just a beat 'em up, so it's like you're progressing. If you stop playing for the day, you can come back to your save file. But if you die and lose 100 credits, it erases that save file, so you're starting from the beginning of the game. So, Streets of Rage 3 back in the day, we're feeling that again, huh?
I really like that. That's a cool twist.
It's really awesome. I like it. And I will say, for people who might be a little bit nervous, compared to the Steam version, they made this one a lot easier. To put it in perspective, I actually beat this game. The Steam version, I couldn't get past like stage 3 because of how challenging it was. So, the way the design is, there's 4 environments you can go to. I'm not going to name them because you should just see them in the game. And depending on when you go to a stage determines how difficult the stage will be and how long the stage is. So if you go to like this, I'm saying this one, I guess. If you go to the sewers first, it'll probably be one section of a level, maybe not even with a boss at the end. But if you go to the sewers as your second stage, there will be 2 levels of the sewer section, like 2 different areas, mind you, not like just here's a longer scroll, but 2 different stages in the sewer area. And a boss will be at the end. And eventually it ends up being like 4 stages with 2 bosses and then another couple of levels after that to wrap up the game. So what does that mean? It means you will not see every level on one playthrough. It's impossible by way of the game being designed. You have to play through the game and do different levels at different phases in your playthrough to see all the stages in the game. But that's an awesome thing to it, I think.
It encourages replayability.
That's for sure. And I think the one thing that's funny that is worth mentioning is Jim Sterling is in the game. So
if
you like Jim Sterling and want to see him in the game, you can pick this up. If you hate Jim Sterling and want to kick his ass in the game, you can pick this up. It's win-win, baby. I mean, but it works out really well. He even voices the guy, too, which I thought was pretty hysterical. But it's honestly a quality game. I had a lot of fun with it. And also, I forgot to mention, the reason why you don't want to necessarily have to spend your money on resurrections, if you can help it, is because after you beat each stage, you have the option to buy one item from a store that gives you upgrades, whether it's a healing boost or modifiers to your special attacks or a variety of different things. There's even a couple of troll items in the game. but you essentially get the option to bolster your character to make them that much better than when you started the game, so long as you have the money to drop the investments. And you only get one buy per level, so you can't like say have like $5,000 and just buy every upgrade. You can only get one at a time, so you can't get everything. Be smart about your buys. And I think one thing that's cool, that if you want the original PC difficulty, they did add that difficulty as like the hardest difficulty, I believe. And how that works is when you beat I guess they give you less food or less healing items. And when you beat a level, in addition to shopping at the store, you can forego all of that if you want to take a nap and rest, and that's how you get your health back. So it's nice. Like, I don't want to spend any money. I just want to heal. But this is a good game. I like this a lot. I had it on Steam originally. Was excited to hear that it got a re-release on consoles with a few twists and turns. There's even some unlockable characters in the game, which the PC version did not have. It's a good product. I did not feel disappointed.
Cool. So I got to know, $9. What do you think of this one?
Easily worth $9. Easily.
Cool.
Buy Sounds the good. Shit out of this.
I want to. I'll probably pick it up on the Switch, unless if Secret Base is listening. Hey, Xbox fans would like to play this too. That'd be nice.
Yeah, I mean, I figure it's already on Steam, so it can't be that hard to transition it, right?
It's on literally everything but Xbox. PC, Switch, PS4, not Xbox. So fingers crossed it'll show up there eventually. Hopefully.
Fingers crossed indeed, because it deserves to be played by as many people as possible. It deserves to get attention because it's a fun title.
Indeed. And then you have one other game to talk about. That is called Sir Eats-a-Lot, developed by Diesling and Ryder, published by East Asia Soft, Released April 3rd on the Vita for $11.99, the Kingdom of Gluttington was at peace until one day Hysterica poisoned the isotonic waters with sour lemonade. That evil witch. The kingdom's crops are withering, but this plague is yet to befall all the lands. There is still hope. King Diotin III dispatches his greatest, bravest, stoutest knight to save the kingdom from certain ruin. Sir Eats-a-Lot. Pernell, what the hell is this game?
Very bizarre. I just think it's kind of funny that the premise of the game is that this lady went and bought like a whole container, cartons of Lipton tea and just, or Lipton lemonade and just poured it into a river. Essentially, I'm going to rule your kingdom by spilling Lipton all over your water sources. No one's going to stop me. Like, you know, it'll just dilute outright. Whatever. Point is, she did it. And now the most obese knight in history is on the job. He's going to save the day. And how does he do that? By touching the screen quite a bit through use of you, the omnipotent one that the game never references. So you're traversing this like a 2D map, and it's essentially like an adventure game. You have to get from the beginning of the game to the end, which is Hysterica, and take her down. But as you do it, as you proceed, there's a rat tribe that she sticks on you to try to stop you from making progress. So as you progress, you might every once in a while come across a rat who will attack you with cheese or dagger or brute force, and you have to use your sword and shield to attack slash defend. I kind of chuckled at the fact that the bomber enemy is a cheese bomber, and he throws cheese at you, and if it hits you, it covers you in cheese. It's sticky. You have to rub the screen to get the cheese off of him. When you do, he eats the cheese, and he gets healed from it.
Oh, my Lord.
There's something funny about that. The entire world that this game is made of is very colorful and artistic. Whoever did the artwork in this game and the animation deserves some legit kudos, because it feels like you're kind of playing a bit of a cartoon. When I originally saw some trailers from the game, I admit I kind of made fun of it, because I think I told you about this before. It's a $30 physical release from PlayAsia, and collectors are eating it up.
$34.99.
They're eating it up.
Ah, I see what you did there.
Chortle. Anyway,
yeah, I was actually going to bring that up when we were done. PlayAsia is doing, PlayAsia and East Asia Soft are doing for $34.99, limited to only 2,000 units.
Yeah, it's like an interesting scenario there, because of the collective Vita collectors market. So then it's like, well, is the game good? So I will say one thing that makes me a little bit upset about the game is it doesn't have a map. If there is, I couldn't find it. But reason why I say it is because every once in a while the game will make it require you to backtrack to do things. Mm. And with there being no map, even with a lot of the areas being fairly linear, every once in a while you'll find yourself going, okay, I ended up in this spot that looks sort of familiar, but is it familiar? I don't know, and I got to figure out where I'm going. So you might turn the wrong direction and lose time walking backwards when you didn't expect to, and free res, you're going the wrong way, and correct yourself. But I mean, overall, I won't lie, I had more fun with this than I expected to. I liked solving the puzzles. There's a couple scenarios where the game will kind of force you to use a little bit of dexterity, and I need to explain a little bit of the gameplay mechanic before I get to this. So everything in this damn kingdom is edible. Like, you can eat, you touch the screen to tap bushes to knock fruit and bubblegum and toward burritos and all kinds of crazy shit off of the fauna and flora, and then you eat it. Some of it gives you health back, some of it gives you stamina back. Sir Eats-a-Lot is very fat and very slow. There's a double tap run, but it drains his stamina very quickly. But he gets his stamina back by eating milkshakes and donuts. I mean, whatever. So you'll find yourself like tapping the screen to knock fruit off of trees so you can eat it while you run to get your stamina up so you can keep running. So sometimes you'll like double tap just to run long enough to make a double jump or something like that. But other times you'll just have to suck it up and just walk to your location because you're just out of shape and can't make it. But there's a couple areas in the game that I thought were pretty cool where like they make you run across like an exploding bridge and you'd have to tap food as you're running so it can fall into his mouth and he'll eat it so he can keep running. Because if you don't get enough food, he'll get tired on the bridge and blow up. So there's some cool stuff like that, and a couple like interesting like puzzles where you have to like slide switches, to, like make ladders drop, or you have to tap the back of the screen because yes, this game uses the back tap, the back touch screen on the Vita too.
Oh wow!
Remember that thing? It's real.
Holy shit!
And there's a trophy called "Yeah, we used it." But you tap the back.
Incredible.
It's hilarious. I was like, wow, somebody didn't forget this damn back screen, because I'll admit, I have my own grievances about how you can apply it, because it's hard to use it with precision, but in this game, they use, if you have to tap the back screen to do something, it's typically on an object that's large enough where you're not like, crap, I missed it. You'll find it, and you'll tap it. It's not going to be a problem. So, but I like the fact that it utilized that. Only thing that's lacking right now is the pinch, and I might have just not gotten to a pinch point yet. Who knows? But there's a number of creative little touchscreen puzzles in the game. I like the artwork in the game. The music's even pretty nice. It's very relaxing and mellow. I don't believe this game was designed in the intent to really challenge so much as relax as you solve the puzzles and explore the world. Like, it's meant to be a feel-good game. If the developer's listening and they think I'm full of crap, please let me know. But my vibe is this is a feel-good adventure game, not meant to frustrate or tax. And I got that vibe from it.
Cool. So for $12, what do you think of this one?
I think it's at least a try. I think it went beyond. For me, this is one of those cases where the game went from I'm not doing shit with this to whoa, I misjudged this title, and I think it's very appealing.
Nice. It's so good when a game can change someone's mind where they're like, oh, this game looks. Then you play it and you're like, you know what? I was wrong. This is a neat game.
Yeah, I think that's a large part of why I like doing these, like doing more of the indie-er games, because, like, what was it? Like, I reviewed Daryl Deluxe on your show last week, and I've been trying for the life of me to convince my friends, you need to try Super Daryl Deluxe. This game is really freaking good. And I would have never thought about it if it weren't for doing it on this show. And people, it's not, you have to convince me. It's not in my budget. I'm like, what are you doing with your time? Well, Far Cry 5 and the God of War's next week. It's like, God of War's three times the price. What the hell?
Unless you buy Collector's Edition, then it's like 10 times the price.
Yeah, it's like, see, games get lost in the shovel and you just don't acknowledge them. Meanwhile, you're dropping full price for these games that, I mean, they're good, but they're there. Like, they don't need that push. They'll be there. They're not going anywhere.
Okay, well, how's this then? The game at $12 is a try it. What about the collector's edition? $35, limited to 2,000, includes the game, a sticker book, a soundtrack, a full color art book, collector's box, and a numbered certificate for $35. Do you think it's worth jumping on that?
I will say the first thing to say is that sticker book is pretty funny because that's thematic. In the game, if you see enemies or characters in the game, you can touch them and then trace them, and you add them to your sticker book. So I'm going to guess that the sticker book on the CE is a reference to that. As for if it's worth that amount of money, that is harder to push, mainly because you can get the game non-physical for half that price right now. And it's at try it level for me. So it's not a guarantee everyone's going to like it. So I don't know if I'd want to push the collectors so much because, and I brought this up to you not too long ago too. This may be like a shot in the foot of sorts, but the Vita is in a really weird place right now where it's on its way out the door and Sony didn't really treat it very well. And people that are diehards for the system want to get everything physical that they can possibly get because they know it's on its way out. It's almost like it's like when the Saturn was on its last null. Like, get everything you can because it won't be there. But what that means is that everybody's putting everything in collector's mode now. Get a collector's physical edition, you can get it, and it'll be on your shelf or whatever. But unfortunately, a lot of the time, those also come with like double, some rare cases, triple the cost of the original game just because you're getting it in a physical package. And
some goodies like an art book and a soundtrack, stuff like that. I think that stuff adds up in value.
That's true. I agree with you on that. But I will say this is this isn't the norm for me. Like, I feel like this being a full on collector's edition differs from what I've seen, where it's like it's literally just the game in a box with no manual or anything.
Oh yeah.
And they charge you triple the price to get it. But with all those bells and whistles, if the game appeals to you at, what was it? It was $12 at the original going rate?
Yeah, $11.99, and the collector edition is $34.99.
I feel like if the game appeals to you off of the try it recommendation and you're a Vita collector, it's probably worth the $35 because you're getting the thematic sticker book and the art. And again, the art is one of the main things I liked about the game. I like the atmosphere. I like the character art, all the cute animals and mess that you come across. The artwork is very nice. So I feel like it's a play by ear to the buyer. But if you're already in collector's mode and you're interested in this game, I don't think you're going to really find yourself crying by buying the CE for it.
Cool. Sounds good. Well, Purnell, always good having you on chatting about this stuff. Do you have any final thoughts to wrap it up?
No, but I know I'm really freaking hungry now talking about a game where you get energy from donuts and milkshakes.
Well, go get yourself some nom noms.
I may, but at the same time, I'm not Sir Eats-a-Lot. I can't save the kingdom on a big stomach. We can't all be Sir Eats-a-Lot, but goddamn, I wish I was.
All right, next game to talk about is called Eat Beat Dead Spike San, developed and published by Arc System Works. It released March 22nd on the Switch for $6.99. Eat Beat Dead Spike San is a rhythm action game spin-off of the 2D fighting game series Blaze Blue that features Dead Spike San in an eating frenzy, set out on a journey to eat more and grow stronger. Checking this one out and a couple of others. Chris Taylor, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great.
What the hell is Eat Beat Dead Spikes on?
I don't know.
Besides an incredible game title.
It's a great title, yes. It's one of the better ones. Okay, so I attempted to do... So, it's based in the Blaze Blue universe, which, by the way, since they omit the E, I prefer to call it Blaze Blue.
That works.
And also, they omit the Z in Japan, so they actually call it Brebru. Hmm. Like, that's how it's pronounced over there. And that's it. That's what it is. No, I'm just kidding.
You're teaching. You're teaching.
Yes. So, yeah. So, it's in the Blaze Blue series. It stars a dude that I guess is the dude that is the star of most of the games. The games proper. I know there's a couple games that have him but don't star him. And I guess at some point he had tamed this cartoony looking sharky animal, and it's just one of those anime things. You know how like a super serious anime will have like either a whole like side show or maybe even just a couple of episodes where everybody's all chibi and it's all cutesy and it's kind of like a parody of itself.
Yeah.
That's kind of like what this game is. So it's all humorous. It's nonsensical. There's no story to speak of. And it is a rhythm game that faithfully recreates a lot of the songs from the series. I know this because I at least know the soundtrack.
Which doesn't surprise me at all that you know a soundtrack to something.
To a game that I have never even seen before. Yes. That is my jam. But Blaze Blue is well known for its soundtracks. I mean, this is a great series for music. It's definitely, so they've got 20 songs in here, and they range from that kind of J-metal where they got like the dual lead guitars and like those heavy drums and like, you know, maybe even and the strings in the background, you know, you totally understand those chord progressions, like sounds like the opening to a badass anime pretty much every time.
Yeah,
it ranges from that into J metal with dual lead guitars, heavy drums, and recognizable chord progressions and melodies that you'll recognize from a badass anime. It's literally the same kind of song 20 times. But it's a very, very good song. And like I said, the charm of this thing is the actual rhythm portion. It's really simple for a rhythm game. You basically have two buttons. You can opt for the left and right shoulder buttons or the A and left buttons on either side of the Joy-Con or the Pro Controller. And basically... This Dead Spike San, whom you have on a leash, I guess you keep your shark silhouette creature on a leash, is just dragging the hero around like he's just completely helpless, and he's eating all the ice creams and the sushis and, you know, the what have yous that are in his path, and each one corresponds to a part of the rhythm, and the rhythm is either the one button or the other button. And so you push the left and right, you know, to the rhythm, with an asterisk, you actually, like, in the game's default setting, for some reason, it seemed like it was way too ahead of the beat, so I was just basically not listening to the song and just focusing on the visual. And then I pulled up the menu, and the menu actually has a where in the beat do you want the button press. And if you put it, like, it starts off all the way into the left where it says you have to push it quickly, so that keeps the buttons ahead of the beat. But if you put it in the middle, it's pretty much right on beat. And I was like, why didn't you just start it in the middle? Because that makes so much more sense. So if you're thrown off by this game, check the options and set that thing to your comfort. Because, yeah, it, by default, it wasn't that appealing. But then once I set it in the middle, I was like, oh, okay, this is the game.
I'll have to do that because I actually picked the game up myself. I played the demo of it, which had two of the songs on there, and I really enjoyed the demo. And it's a rhythm game, which I love, so I decided to pick it up. And the timing just always felt weird to me, and I never thought to look into the calibration in the settings because I figured it's on a handheld. It should just be calibrated.
Right. That's what I was thinking. But yeah, it, and it's the same on the TV. It's like, it's exactly the same. So I was like, well, all right. I guess that's just, I don't know. I can't explain it, but at least it's fixed. Yeah. It's a fixable thing. And you can even set it to where it's way slower than the beat, which sounds like a nightmare. I don't know why you would do that.
Well, it's not that it's way slower than the beat. It's to make up for the calibration settings and the audio lag with modern day surround systems.
Yeah, so, you know, season to taste, and you'll enjoy this. You'll enjoy this this wacky little rhythm game. Like, you know, it's 20 levels, it's 3 difficulties. I personally didn't really see any challenge until I put it in hard mode, but once I put it in hard mode, it was very satisfying. I quite enjoyed you know, even though it's just 2 buttons, it kind of works like Taiko Drum Master in that sense. Like, there, it even has those little segments where it's just freeform, where you just tap the buttons as fast as you can for bonus points.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's very much like a Taiko Drum Master sort of thing, but with 2 buttons. And like I said, the incredibly J-metal dual lead guitar heavy drums, recognizable guitar chords from a badass anime opening soundtrack from BlazBlue.
And I see no problems with that at all.
Oh, no. Literally, I only have one complaint, and that's that they switched the B and the A buttons functions in the menu.
So you have to push that, too.
Isn't that the worst? And you can't change that.
That's how it is on, like, every other console, but Nintendo has to be weird about it.
I know.
I was used to it right away. I was confused when, you know, I don't know. It was normal. To me,
I kept pushing A and it kept bringing up the menu, and then, like, there's no real, it doesn't say push B to start, it just shows you the splash screen, and you're meant to touch the screen, I think. But I was playing on the TV, so I was like, what do I do? And then when I pushed B, it started the game, and I was like, oh,
nice,
it's one. it took an embarrassingly long time for me to figure that out the first time.
Well, $7 on this one, what do you think?
Look, there are precious few rhythm games on the Switch. Like, I think they've released one this year so far, and they've got 2 good ones on the horizon, and I think they did 6 last year. So, look, if you're thirsty for rhythm games, this is perfect. It's very fun. You don't have to know the lore, because as far as if you're like me and you've never played BlazBlue, then it's just a bunch of anime characters and some really good music. So how could you go wrong? If you are a fan of the series, then by gosh, do pick this up, because I mean, that's the whole thing. Like, they have all kinds of spin-off games for all kinds of systems. So, cause the fans of this game series are really fans, and this will, I think this will satisfy you in that, you know, you get to, you know, in a theater rhythm Final Fantasy sort of way, you get to hear the songs and interact with them a little bit more rather than play a really cool fighting game.
No.
So either way, it's pretty much a winner.
I absolutely agree. And from a rhythm gamer standpoint, 20 songs for $7 is absolutely worth it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's got some unlockables, too. So I think, you know, might even have more. I don't know.
Has 4,000 songs.
Nice.
It may or may not have 4,000 songs.
Right on.
What is with my throat tonight? Jesus. Next game to talk about is called Rogue Aces, developed by Infinite State Games, published by Curve Digital, released April 12th on the Switch, PS4, and Vita for $12.99, and is a cross-buy game between PS4 and Vita. Join the Rogue Aces today is Wings McPilot and Company in this procedurally generated adrenaline-fueled fight to the last plane. It's time to join the Rogue Aces and liberate the islands from the Baron and his dreaded pilots. Will you be able to face the fiercest of foes with only one life and three planes? Chris, did you?
Oh, I faced him. I faced him again and again. For one thing, I mean, oh my god, what is the pilot's name again?
It is Wings McPilot.
Wings McPilot.
So which is incredible.
$12.99, go buy it. That's literally when I read the description and I read Wings McPilot, I was like, okay, I gotta, please let me do this one. Okay, so yeah, Rogue Aces is a really, really interesting one. And dare I say, probably my favorite indie shmup that's now available on Switch. Ooh. Like, you know, Psycheo and Aero Fighters notwithstanding, of course, because I love those. But no, this game is really good. So basically, yeah, it's a roguelike and it's also a shooter. So the even the title is perfect. So you start the game off, it's World War II era, and you know, you've got the hello, you know, like, you know, good old World War II. Yeah, stereotypical, you know, pilots from old Blighty. And yeah, like there's Wings McPilot, and then there's a lady who I don't know what her name is, but I played as her the whole time because I just really like her voice. It's that very posh, like, you know, Jane from Tarzan kind of voice. So I really enjoyed that. So yeah, you basically start on an aircraft carrier, and you've got your commander who says all these ridiculous things. It's very English and very ridiculous. And then also it has that thing where instead of the actor reading the actual dialogue on the screen, they just have these preset things that they say, like, you know, chip cheerio and, you know, all that other stuff. And, you know, they say things like, well, let's get a war started then. And, like, just awesome stuff. And so then you play in these, I don't know what you would call them, like just these World War II planes, whatever, biplanes, I guess. And you have, of course, the infinite shot. You have a store of initially three bombs that you can drop and two torpedoes that you can shoot that are like a really high powered shot. The controls is probably what my favorite part is, because instead of being the typical horizontal shmup where you just go up and down, like when you turn the control, you actually swoop and start to like go up, and then you can like complete that turn and like complete the loop. And so it becomes this really intuitive sort of, really feels like you're flying an airplane rather than, you know, piloting a spaceship, but it looks like an airplane. So once you get used to the controls, of course, like I said, you got your infinite shot thing. This, you know, they let you know where all the enemies are and where the goals are, and your goals are randomly set. So he'll be like, you know, go shoot those two, you know, bogeys out of the air. Would you? There's a good chap. And so, you know, you go, they literally will say things like, there's a good chap. And yeah, quite so you right. go, yeah, quite right, quite right. It reminds me of that that, you know, Bertram game. it's kind of along that ilk. So yeah, then you shoot the airplanes down, and then it tells you to take out an ammunition dump, tells you you know, eventually you'll come up with something a lot more challenging where you have to take down planes full of paratroopers, and then you have to take out all the paratroopers. And every time that you defeat a challenge, you then have to make it back to the aircraft carrier. And thank God there's an auto land button. So like you don't have to land it. You just have to get near it and then push, you know, B at the right time, and yeah, it'll auto land. And then it, you know, fixes you up, restores all your ammo, and then sends you right back out again. There's no level breaks. So you just keep doing this stuff, and it goes on a day-night cycle, so like that's how you kind of know how many levels you've done, is like how late it is. And I've never had it change scenery on me. I've gotten through like 10 challenges in a row and never saw like another scene, but they keep setting things up over in the land that you go over to shoot, so you know, they keep it fresh. And yeah, it's just like a lot of fun. It's pretty darn challenging, but it's really cool because like it handles it somewhat realistically, because if your plane blows up and your pilot escapes, if you land in the water or someplace that's relatively safe, then it just lets you go to your next ship, and you have three ships that you see right there on the boat. But if your pilot like lands on the ground and like dies or something like that, then you actually die. And then you have to start the whole game over.
Ooh.
However, and this is where this is the kind of roguelike I really enjoy, you gain levels that stay with you as you start the game over.
Nice.
And each new level gives you like certain, I think, passive power-ups, as well as the ability to select a power-up that sort of it randomly generates two, and then you can just pick from the two. And then you get to go into the next fight with like that extra boost.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
So $13 on this one. What do you think of Wings McPilot?
This could easily be a $20 game and I would be singing its praises. So yeah, shmup fans, check this out. This is a unique title. I have never played anything like this, and it's really fun. It's good for like shmup people. It's good for people who, you know, just enjoy getting out there and seeing how far they can get. And like I said, you gain levels through it. So you're eventually, you know, going to have this really high powered ship, I imagine.
Nice. Well, a couple of minutes ago, you mentioned some shmups and you mentioned Aerofighters. So that leads us into our next batch of games. We have three Neo Geo Arcade Archives games to talk about. And we'll start off with Aerofighters 3. As usual, console version developed and published by Hamster. This one was out March 14th on Xbox One, Switch, and PS4 for $7.99. Unmatched high-speed fighters fly on their advanced reciprocating planes to fight. Aerofighters 3 is a side-scrolling shooting game from 1995, released by Video System. 10 teams comprised of 14 humans and 2 animals have gathered from around the world and are flying on high-powered reciprocating engine planes such as the Zero Fighter to save the world. Chris, tell us about Aerofighters.
That's a kind of inaccurate description. It's not side-scrolling. It's vertically scrolling. So, because that's Aerofighters, that's how it goes.
Oh, yes, that's their description.
Okay. Well, Aerofighters 3 is another chapter, of course, in the fantastic Aerofighters series, the one that more or less spawned Psycho, although Video Systems is a little different from Psycho. They kind of like split off and were both kind of developing side by side. So this is, of course, a sequel to Aerofighters 2, which I mentioned contains some of my favorite instances of like bad and awkward English. This one is sadly much improved. So the writing is far better, but you still get in good jabs. Like old Spanky the Dolphin is back. The first ever dolphin pilot, I think, is how he describes himself. And the first stage has you destroying the Capitol building. And he says, the Capitol was destroyed. Well, what can you do? And yeah, like it has,
which is just a normal natural reaction to the Capitol being destroyed.
Yeah, if you're a dolphin who is a pilot. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, it's like it has little, you know, bizarre lines like that, but nothing like, you know, fry to Paris and save the city from destruction, or one of my favorite, put a fish in your mouth.
Oh, God.
Anyway, I love Aerofighters. So what's different between this one and two, besides the new translation, is that you now have you have four different countries to choose from, and it's up to a two-player game, so you can play two players simultaneously. However, you can't mix and match them exactly like you could in Aerofighters 2. They have to be from the same country. So when you choose like Russia, that's Spanky the Dolphin, and you're also choosing like these bizarre Russian teenage girl twins, I guess. I don't really know. And their special bomb is that they send a gigantic Petrushka doll out there, you know, the dolls with the little dolls inside of them.
Yeah.
And it just like just completely wrecks everything, and it's kind of great. So the one thing that I love that's a special touch is that like each country has its own currency that like your points, if you get instead of like just dollar signs, like it might be, you know, yen for Hien, the famous difficult and lonely ninja, or in the case of Spanky, it's F for fish.
Oh, God.
So you collect bonus fish. I love that. Anyway, so The other thing about this one, I really love the soundtrack more. It's very drum and bassy. It's got vocal samples that are like kind of, you know, cut up in really interesting ways. The only weird thing is that I had to like turn up my sound like all the way to hear anything in the game. And then when I went to the menu and it like does that, you know, like, like that was super, super loud. So it's a quiet game for some reason.
Interesting.
But, you know, once you get into it, it's got a great soundtrack. You can adjust the sound of the soundtrack versus the explosions, but you can't, like, make it all much louder. I guess the other thing about it versus 2 is that while it does have, like, these really great epic boss battles, usually the stages last a little over 1 minute. Like, they're very short stages.
So quick in and out.
Quick in and out, yeah. And also, like Aero Fighters 2, you have to beat it once to get the character ending, and then you have to beat it a second time in a higher difficulty level with a different final boss in order to get the true ending, which is to say the roll credits. But the roll credits is the same across all the characters. So
awesome game, lots to do, lots of endings, $8. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely get this one. I mean, if you're a vertical shooter fan, then you should have already been waiting for this one to come out. So if you're a casual, go ahead and get it, because Aero Fighters in the arcade, you know, series is one of the few that lets you move your default stock of lives and continues up to 99.
Nice.
So you can totally like rich kid strat your way through this game and get the best ending. I did in the first 20 minutes. So, but it's legit one of the best like challenging bullet hell games from the olden days. So casuals and hardcores are going to love this.
Cool. Good stuff. We're going to stick with the 3 theme, and the next one to talk about is Sengoku 3, developed and published, of course, by Hamster. This one was out March 28th, Xbox One, Switch, and PS4 for $7.99. Take out the undead in a variety of ways. The hyper-action ninja game is now here. Sengoku 3 is a side-scrolling action game released by SNK in 2001. In order to purge malicious souls, shinobi travel the world to defeat the undead, cut, smash, throw, and use weapons as well as ninja arts and ultimate ninja arts in this hyper-action ninja game. I checked this one out because I had it on Xbox, and there was a little snafu with the code, so whatever.
Oh, no.
Shockingly, this is a sequel to the first 2 Sengoku games, which means this is another side-scrolling brawler. There's 4 characters you could pick from the start, though as you progress through the game, you are able to unlock others that you can play with. Each character has their own unique attacks, weapon attacks. They have special attacks that you could hit down twice and then one of the 2 attack buttons, and it does, I guess those are the ultimate ninja arts and the ninja art attacks. The game starts where you're able to pick from 3 different stages. As you complete those 3, it opens up to more stages that you're able to go through. It's fun. It's Sengoku. It's more of what you expect from the series, though I will say I've played all 3 of the Sengoku games. This one is the most frustratingly difficult of the 3.
Oh, man. Oh, boy.
I don't know if it's because it's the newest. Like, I was surprised to see a Neo Geo game from 2001. Like, in my mind, yeah, those ended in the 90s, but, you know, I guess not. This one, even on... Because the Neo Geo games, you're able to adjust the level of the difficulty. And when I play the standard game, because I'll go through, play the standard game, put it on like the easiest difficulty, give myself a bunch of lives just so I could get a feel of the game. And then I'll mess around with the highest score in the caravan modes, which are on default difficulty. Even on the easiest difficulty, this game got just brutally difficult and to the point where it was just unfair. You would have enemies surrounding you. They would have unblockable attacks, because there is no block in the game, but just attacks that you're not able to get out of the way from. It's just attacks that will always hit you no matter what. They have invincibility frames where you can attack them and it does nothing.
Oof.
They surround you. They ping pong you around. It is just frustratingly difficult. Out of the 3, sadly, this one is probably my least favorite because of the difficulty. It's the most polished. It has the most characters. It is easily the most advanced of the 3. It's just difficulty-wise, it is not balanced properly. $8 on this one. It's still a lot of fun, though. And if you want to find Sengoku 3 anywhere else, it's going to cost you hundreds of bucks. So $8, I still give it a try. It's still fun. It's still enjoyable. It's just going to test your patience and test your resolve of whether or not you can put up with the cheating asshole computers.
Yeah, like when a side-scrolling brawler gets like super difficult, it always feels like just it you just feel life draining from you.
Yeah. Your soul always, is just draining of like, oh my god, why is this so unfair?
That's always how I felt about the original Final Fight.
I mean, they're arcade games. They're supposed to take your quarters, but when it's on the easiest difficulty, you know, be a little more approachable in late game stages, but I don't know.
Oh, for sure.
One more Neo Geo game, and that is Gururin. Hopefully I'm saying that right.
Developed,
once again, developed and published by Hamster. This one was out April 11th on Xbox One, Switch, and PS4. Again, $7.99. Spin left, spin right, spin, 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 spin the square magic troop, gain victory by getting luck on your side. Gururin is an action puzzle game released in 1994 by FACE. Enjoy a puzzle game the likes of which you've never seen before while rotating the magic troop Gururin. Briss, what the hell is this one?
Well, that description is a bit misleading because you actually don't spin anything in this game, so... I'm just kidding. actually, that is
it's another shmup. No.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually an accurate description because it is spinning. It is a puzzle game, and it is unlike anything you'll ever see. So Gururin is this just bizarre thing. It seems to be set kind of an old timey, you know, samurai warriors and monks and all that other stuff. It's a puzzle game. I want to say. Okay, so what it looks a little bit like is, you remember the old Yoshi game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you would have like a blooper and or whatever they're called bloopers, right? The octopi, okay.
Blooper.
And then okay, there you go. You would have those, and then it would be next to another critter, and then you would like stack them, and you had to like kind of rotate them and stack them in the right kind of stacks. And then, you know, when you got enough and you got that egg, you close it. So this has things dropping in pairs, and they're all soldiers or monks or people, like just little people, are dropping down into the playing field. And you can move them from left to right, but that's the only thing that you get to do with the people directly. Everything else is rotating the entire playing field. So... And the goal is that you have to match at least three. And if you match three, then they disappear and, you know, it affects the opponent. Or it just, actually in one player mode, it's three instead of two. And then you just try to just keep, you know, keep up with it. Kind of an endless mode sort of thing. So, once you get your guys like lined up, then they disappear. So the trick here is like the best way to play is to try and set up combos where basically you set it up to where once you rotate the field, they drop into place and disappear. And then the next set drop into place and all this other stuff. The game's attract mode shows like a really awesome way of doing this that I could not duplicate in the actual game because this game is a, this is one of those brain melting kind of puzzle games. Like, I feel like this is how I felt about Wario's Woods when it first came out. Is that I understand what is expected of me, but to actually do it, I'm gonna have to play this for like a year before I actually get good at it. And you know, the computer opponents do not care about that. They're gonna murder you. So. Yeah. It took me a very long time to beat the first level, and I think it was a fluke. I think they actually accidentally bombed. And it's like a little kid who's like, please don't hurt me. So you're like, oh my god. Yeah. And then you go up against a pig who appears to be chopping meat. So
it's good.
It's got that really over-the-top wacky, like, you know, humor that you would expect on a Neo Geo or like just an obscure Japanese sort of game. But yeah, this still, like, I tried and tried and tried and tried, and I never failed to have fun with it. Like, it was actually really fun and really interesting. It's just that, like I said, it was brain frying, and I was just like, oh, I'm so frustrated that I'm not seeing these patterns like come up, because I'm something of a very good player when it comes to like Tetris Attack, which if you start playing it, it's similarly like people are like, oh, I don't get how to do this. And I'm like, well, just keep doing it. You'll eventually get it.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about this, except now I'm at the bottom and I'm like, I don't understand.
Started from the bottom.
Yeah.
Gotta work your way up.
Yep. And yeah, besides that, there are power-ups to help you out. Sometimes you can clear a whole line. Sometimes it does weird things that I don't understand. And sometimes it seems to do nothing. I don't know. So it seems like there's a lot to get used to in this game, and the game does not offer to hold your hand on much. It basically spends the whole tutorial just showing you turning the stages and stuff like that. And by the way, that's another aspect of it. You can only turn the stage before the people fall into it. So you only have this brief window where you can turn the stage. You can't just turn it any time. So that's another interesting angle to it.
This is one I haven't played myself, so I'm very, very intrigued in playing it. I bought it. I just haven't had time to sit down and play it yet.
It looks like, having played it, it's really fun, and I see the potential for this being a really, really cool game to, like, master, you know, to like really get good at it and like really show off to people, because it's not like Tetris. You don't, you know, it's not just easy to master easy to play, difficult to master. It's difficult to play in the beginning. And like I said, it's all through design. It's a game that does exactly what it wants to do. Yeah. And I applaud it for that reason.
Well, like, you know, the question, $8. What do you think?
Like, one of the biggest selling points to me in a puzzle game is unique approach, because there's only so many times we can play Bejeweled or, you know, whatever. So I give it a buy it just for that. Definitely for the action puzzle connoisseur. And it's definitely obscure enough that I've never heard of it. And I love puzzle games and I love Neo Geo games. So the fact that I've never come across it until it was time to play it, to review it, is pretty impressive on the obscurity scale.
Nice.
So go ahead and seek this one out. I think you'll be glad you did.
Sounds good. You have one more game to talk about. And this is a really, really cool one. Another Arcade Archives game, Punch-Out. Originally developed by Nintendo, console release developed and published by Hamster. This one came out March 30th on the Switch for $7.99. Power, speed, technique, who will be the one to knock the champion down? Punch-Out is a sports action game released by Nintendo in 1984. Watch your opponent's expressions and moves as you use a variety of punches and defensive moves on your path to become the boxing champion. The game became extremely popular with the double monitor setup, including intense boxing with dynamic graphics. Chris, tell us about the arcade version of Punch-Out.
Finally, the arcade version of Punch-Out. My God.
Is this first time ever on a home console, I believe?
I think it is. It's not come out on any other Nintendo system. So it has to be, right?
Yeah. Like,
Nintendo has too much of an iron grip on that. So here we have, until we're proven wrong by the internet, the debut of the friggin' Punch-Out arcade game, upon which the original NES game is based. No Mike Tyson involved here, actually. Funny enough, people always made fun of the Mr. Dream character, but like, Mr. Dream is not in this one. It's the guy before Mike Tyson is the Mr. last boss. Sandman. Anyway, No. The guy who's like the big movie star guy with the big pecs.
Vodka Drunkinsky.
No. Not Vodka Drunkinsky. He's the other guy. Damn it.
Super Macho Man.
Yeah, sure. That sounds like it. I think that is it.
There's been a lot of characters in Punch-Out, people.
God, there have been.
There have been so many.
Yeah. And this piece of history is quite amazing because, as you said, 1984, it predates the NES. And yet it looks like a much more advanced game than it is. It's, it's got giant sprites that do the scaling and, that kind of thing like you would see on the Super Nintendo. Your character is a 3D sort of, like, the way they handled it before they came up with the NES version is that Little Mac is actually just, I guess he's just Mac because he's the same size as the other boxers. And once you're actually playing, he turns into an invisible grid. So like a little green, sort of a polygonal almost grid that you can see right through.
Like a wireframe.
A wireframe, exactly. And it works really well. The game is a little bit, like, if you're used to the NES version, then you'll have to get unused to it because this game is actually a lot more demanding in terms of strategy and being able to dodge and counterattack. So, and the enemies, of course, this being an arcade game, are much harder, except for, of course, good old Glass Joe, who still there, still, you know, holding up the front line. But yeah, you'll see a lot of characters you recognize. Piston Hurricane, you know, you see Bald Bull, of course. They're because of the large pixels that like scale, like when they come up closer in the screen and like shrink back, they actually to me look a little disturbing. I was like, these guys look really rough and ugly, but I guess that was the whole point. But yeah, so. You know, there's a couple of little quirks on this one. Like I said, the playing style is different. You know, you can you basically run up a meter in order to use your super uppercut, and you can still, of course, do the timed punches to sort of like knock them down immediately. But it's not just all about that. There's a lot of like just good old basic pugilism going on here. It also has voice acting. It announces every punch that you do.
It does.
It does. That's going to, and that becomes a little bit of a, like, an amusement for sure. But yeah, so it's basically, like I said, it's the original Punch-Out as, like, I got to play it, the actual arcade version. The last time I got to play that was, I think, 2012. And it is pretty much exactly like I remember it, so. This is it's a very good piece of history.
And what I loved about this version is because the original arcade game was dual monitors, they have a bunch of different ways that you could set up the screens on this. I think the default is one on the left, one on the right. Of course, because it's a hamster game, they have an option where you could tilt spin the screen. The gamepad. That's the word. Holy shit. What is wrong with me tonight? You could turn the gamepad on its side and have the vertical orientation of, you know, the normal top monitor and bottom monitor. Or they also have it where you can have it, you know, in the normal horizontal layout, but with the monitor still top and bottom, you just have a bunch of dead space on the side. But, I enjoy the fact that they have those different options for how you have the monitors, and this makes me kind of hopeful that maybe we see a Play Choice 10 one of these days.
How fucking awesome would that be? I know, right?
Then again, they're already working on doing the Versus games. We've already covered Versus Mario Brothers and Versus Super Mario Brothers, and I know they confirmed Excite Bikes on the way as well. So,
I thought it was already out. It's just on the way, huh?
Did Excitebike come out? I don't think it did.
Maybe it didn't. Maybe I just saw it in the coming soon and bookmarked it or something.
Maybe. Oh, there's been so many. Hamster's been on fire with all these releases. As you could tell, given we are reviewing four of them back to back to back to back.
Oh, yeah.
So Punch-Out, Arcade Archives Punch-Out, $8. What do you think? Because in my eyes, this is a hearty, hearty, hearty buy this fucking game. Because there's no other way to get this game besides buying an arcade machine.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you have a Switch and you don't have this game in your collection, then what are you doing?
Yeah, seriously. What's your problem?
I mean, I was going to buy this game anyway, without reviewing it. And then, you know, actually, I accidentally wound up with this one because I was supposed to do Sengoku 3. And then, like, the code ended up being for Punch-Out.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, that sounds good.
Yeah, so... Well,
I like Sengoku, but I love Punch-Out, so...
Worked out anyway, so...
Yes.
Oh, man. Chris, always good having you on chatting about this stuff. Do you have any final thoughts to sum up that massive deluge of games?
I don't know. Destroy the capital, because, you know, what are you going to do?
All right, next game to talk about is called Regalia of Men and Monarchs Royal Edition, developed by Pixelated Milk, published by Crunching Koalas, released April 12th on Xbox One, Switch, and PS4 for $24.99. After your father's passing, you inherit a wondrous land far, far away. There's a catch, however. Your realm is drowning in terrible debt. Now, through some good old-fashioned adventuring, you have to return your family seat to its long-gone greatness. Checking this one out and phoning it in, of all things. Len Stewart, how are you doing, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing good, Joe. How's it going with you?
It's going. We're going to try making this phone thing work.
Yeah, this will be interesting.
I don't do phone often, but when we have to do it, we got to do it. So let's see how this goes. But how is Regalia? What is this game?
Regalia is strategy RPG, and I love strategy RPGs, and this one doesn't fail to disappoint. I really like the story. Story is really good. It's actually more funny than it is good. You know, it has a lot of like relatable humor in it, and the voice acting is excellent. And we can all like, you know, relate to Endless Debt, you know.
So, oh God, yeah.
Yeah. The characters, I feel like they feel like more genuine than a regular like RPG. Like without all the natural stereotypes that you usually see, you know, which is really cool. Kickstarter. It was Kickstarter, like my RPG, like Pixel Noir.
You just got to get that plug in.
Yeah, it has twice as many Kickstarters as us, you know, but, they actually met their 90K, you know, thing. Whereas ours, we wanted a 90K goal, but we never reached it the first time around.
Oh, yeah, next time you'll get it. So what all do you do in Regalia?
Basically, it kind of works on like a way where it's time. So you have like days of time where you go through and you try to meet objectives before the debt collector comes and either throws you in jail or takes your money. It's basically like a time-based, there's time-based objectives. So you have to like, explore a certain number of regions and, and each region has like, combat, like kind of like a, choose your own adventure type of thing or, like a rest area. I really like the choose your own adventure type things because I kind of grew up on those, Lone Wolf series. By John Denver.
Hell yeah, man. I fucking love those books.
Yeah. So it had like those and like certain objectives in the game, and I thought that was really cool. And it would like either throw you into a battle or you could get like rewarded instantly and get all kinds of loot. It was pretty neat. I was going to say another thing that's really cool with this too is that you have like a social link type of thing, kind of like in Persona. Where, like, the people that you have in your town, you can grow relationships with and, you know, better parts of the town by talking with them, become more friendly with them. So that was pretty cool.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
So you mentioned getting thrown in jail. If you get thrown in jail by the debt collector, is that game over, or are you able to work your way out?
Oh, no. It's game over.
It's not often you see, like, a hard game over in a strategy RPG.
Yeah, you do if you die.
Yeah, but then you just pick up at like your last save or the battle starts back over. It seems like it's more final in this, though.
It is, yeah, it is kind of more final. Like, that's why I was keeping like multiple saves, so like even if I screwed up, like I could actually go back and be like, oh yeah, okay, you know, I don't have a day without doing any objectives now, you know. Yeah. I liked that the battles, had all kinds of, like, win objectives, like, all kinds of weird stuff where you would have to either place certain party members in a different place, or get to the end of the map. There was a lot of different, obstacles rather than just beating your, enemies to death. Yeah. And it also had, some bonus objectives too, so you could actually, like, go in and say, like, if none of your party member dies, you get, like, half as much, you know, half, as much more experience than you would normally get. And, like, other loot and stuff like that, too. It's pretty neat.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I'm hearing a lot of good stuff about the game. Are there any negatives that you had? Any issues?
Yeah, I actually thought that there was really two things that kind of bothered me. The load times. I'm not sure if this is just in Xbox or all consoles, but the load times were just, like, really staggering to me. Yeah. I did like in the load times, though, that it would teach you more about, like, the mechanics of the game, or it would tell you a summary of what just happened in the story. So if you just went through a story part, and it went through a ton of dialogue, and you get to a loading screen, it'll actually tell you what just happened in that scene. I thought that was pretty cool. But the load times are crazy. I just couldn't take it after a while.
That's a bummer, but I guess load times could always be worked on, right?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, you know, it's definitely something that's probably better in other systems. I do have an older Xbox One, so that could be the issue. Yeah. Also, the UI selection was kind of weird. Like, I like the design of the UI, like, you know, going through the different systems in the game, but I felt like the UI selection was, like, really hard to see or notice. I couldn't see where my cursor was to go to different options in the menus. It was kind of annoying.
Now, overall, those sound like fairly minor gripes for the game. Is that pretty much it that bothered you?
Yeah, I mean, the story in an overall wasn't really like a serious story, yet the humor was more relating, so I don't really know how to talk about that. I was kind of like thinking like, yeah, the story's crappy, but hey, the humor's good and the situations are actually believable. So that, I don't know if that's a bad thing or a good thing.
Well, I'm a fan of humor in games, so that's a positive on my end.
Cool. Yeah.
So
no, I actually really did like this game. It was pretty cool.
Cool. So $25 on this thing. What do you think of it?
I definitely think it's worth it, man. I think I would have paid probably like, you know, around 40 for it, to be honest.
Well, don't give them any ideas.
Yeah. So they're an indie developer, so they can use all the money they can get, I think.
Very true. And hey, you're a new developer too, so maybe I should get those guys on to review Pixel Noir when it's out.
Yeah, there you go.
We could do a review trade. That'd be fun.
Yeah, I can't necessarily review my own game. That would be kind of weird.
Yeah, that'd be awkward. So, Len, tell us about Pixel Noir.
Tell you about it. You mean like what's happening with it right now?
No, I was going to say to review it, but...
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, since you asked.
I give it a 4 out of 10.
Yeah, I actually give it a 2 out of 10. It wasn't all that good. You know,
5 out of 7. Perfect score.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, Len, always good having you on chatting about this stuff. Do you have any final thoughts to wrap up the game?
No, not really. One thing that I did miss, though, was the art. I really like the art in it. Very much... like storybooky type art. I thought that was kind of cool. A lot of choose your own adventure references in this game, actually, which I really like I mentioned before. I thought that was a really breath of fresh air for the strategy RPG franchise, you know.
All right, next game to talk about is called The House of Da Vinci, developed and published by Blue Brain Games. It released November 24th on Steam for $19.99. Enter The House of Da Vinci, a new must-try 3D puzzle adventure game. Solve mechanical puzzles, discover hidden objects, escape from rooms, and dive in authentic atmosphere of the Renaissance. Use all your wits to find out what's behind your master's disappearance. Checking this one out. Ian Griffin, how are you doing, man?
Why, hello, Joseph. I'm doing just fine.
Oh,
hello.
It's so wonderful to hear you're doing good.
Yes, I know. I'm so looking forward to the snow that we're due for in a day or two in the middle of April. It makes so much sense. Global warming for the win.
Oh my god, snow.
Oh my, seriously, you guys are getting snow up there?
Not yet, but we are due anytime now.
Oh my god.
Because there was a, I don't know if it was an official winter advisory warning, but upstate we're supposed to be getting like freezing rain, possible hail, possible snow, that kind of... really obnoxious gray area of shit-tastic weather.
Nice.
So, we're we're kind of, you know, so we had this, you know, the lovely weekend where temperature was up in the 50s, and now we're back to trying to be all winter and shit again.
We went from mid 30s to 80, and now we're back in the 40s today in a 3-day span. Wow. What the fuck?
Yeah, we didn't get up to 80s. Oh man, I could have gotten so much yard work done.
Maybe it was high 70s, but it was up. Like, yeah. We had the air conditioners running because it was hot in our place.
Yeah, for us, we only got up to like the low mid 50s. Yeah. And that was just like Friday, Saturday, and now we're kind of down in that 30-ish range again. And like I said, we're supposed to be getting snow sometime like tomorrow, Wednesday, you know, like, and there's all sorts of weather. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, speaking of things being cool, how's the House of Da Vinci? Segway, huh?
Yeah, I know, right? I really enjoyed it. It kind of brought me back to like the old style, you know, like puzzle games I used to really get into way back when. I'm trying to think, because there's a game that a lot of other people like referred to called The Room, not to be confused with the horribly craptastically funny movie by
Tommy Wiseau. The cinematic masterpiece.
Yeah. But apparently there's another game called The Room that apparently a lot of people kind of compare it against. I've never heard or played it, so I can't really testify to that. But I really enjoyed the House of Da Vinci. I really liked the puzzles. The controls were a little weird to get used to. I don't think you would have an issue because, well, here's the thing. The controls kind of have like an inverted design to them, but it's inverted horizontally and vertically.
Interesting.
And the weird thing is that changes when you start to manipulate like a puzzle, well, for the general catch-all, a puzzle. So basically, if you're trying to free spin the camera, all the controls are inverted, but when you go to manipulate a puzzle, it's like back to normal. Quote unquote, back to normal.
Is there anything in the settings for that?
Well, yeah. I mean, you can invert the camera, but everything reverses itself again.
Mm.
So, like, I know you usually prefer working with an inverted camera.
Goddamn
so,
right.
So just free looking the camera around and everything, like I said, it does it horizontally too. So that kind of gets a little bit to get used to. But the thing is that, like, for me, I kind of went around like, oh man, okay, well, hold on, let me invert the camera. So I switched it and moving the free camera around, but as soon as I had to go into a puzzle, everything's backwards again.
Oh Lord.
So you have to deal with the setting both ways. I mean, it's like, which would you rather have the camera set to when you're doing whatever?
That is very weird. I wonder if that's just a glitch that no one has ever brought up before.
Well, you kind of get used to it after a while. I mean, it's one of those things. You either acclimate to it or you just have to suck it up and deal.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, it's not so big of an issue that it's a detriment to the game, and it's not such a huge issue that, you know, I feel it knocks off points from the overall review. It's just, it is what it is.
It's just something to keep you bitching and whining the whole time, right?
Yeah. And like I said, you know, even, you know, I just kind of got used to it after a while. Every now and again, I would accidentally yank the camera in the wrong direction or move the object in the wrong direction, but, you know, there's more important things. But it was very enjoyable. It was very, you know, like, and it kind of gives you like a semblance of a tutorial without trying to beat you over the head with it. You know, it's like basically like, this is what you do to move the camera around. This is what you do to manipulate items and stuff like that. And the puzzles have a very, one thing I will say is the puzzles have like a very, very pleasant, challenge curve. Cause at first, like, you know, in each, the game is pretty much divided up into rooms. And the ultimate objective is to figure out how to progress to the next room. And the number of puzzles and how they interact with each other and how, you know, and trying to figure out the sequence in which to order to do this, in order to get that, in order to unlock this, in order to open that, until ultimately you can leave the room. It's very, a very pleasant and a very smooth, heightening of difficulty. Because the first few puzzles that you run into, I mean, they're pretty easy peasy, you know, to kind of get you into the move and everything like that. But by the time you're at the end of the game, like, I wouldn't quite say the puzzles are mind-bending, but it kind of, you end up developing a mental checklist of things you have to go through in order to make sure that, you know, because a couple of times I got stuck, and the only reason I got stuck was because there was something like I just didn't physically see because I didn't pan the camera to a specific angle in order to see something I was supposed to interact with. And in a way, it's like, it's sort of my fault because, you know, I didn't look hard enough, but in a way it's almost, you can kind of sort of argue that it might be the game's fault for putting it in such a difficult location. But, one thing that the game does strongly emphasize throughout the entire thing, because, like, as you're following after Da Vinci through his workshop and everything, because that's kind of the whole premise of the thing, and that's really, just a sidetrack, is that the story in itself is compelling enough to keep you going. Because there were a couple times where it's like, man, I feel like looking up a walkthrough just so I can get to the end and see what the story's all about. But I don't want to push out and, you know, because there's that other part of you, you know, it's like, you know, why do you climb a mountain? Because it's there. Why do you solve the puzzle? Because it's there. Because you don't want to be that pussy that, you know, isn't smart enough to figure out the puzzle.
No.
So, you know, and one thing that is strongly emphasized is, you know, always be observant, always be mindful of everything, always look at everything. And when it comes to looking at everything, there are two very unique mechanics that come into play. And you pick up what I call is the Divinity Gauntlet. It's basically this big, huge leather gauntlet. Kind of looks like the Infinity Gauntlet, but it's made by Da Vinci, hence the name Divinity Gauntlet. But anyways, you get these two special lenses, and one of them is basically like an X-ray lens. Like, you can look at certain objects and or puzzles, and you can see the inner workings. And from there, you can that's the puzzle. You manipulate, like, for example, there's a hatch you have to open, and just looking at it on the outside, you don't see shit. You really can't interact with shit, but you activate the little X-ray lens, and then you all of a sudden see all the pins and the tumblers and stuff, and you have to start figuring out how that works in order to open it. And the other lens, which I find to be a very interesting mechanic, it's sort of like a, I'm not even sure how to really describe it. It's like a time lens. Basically, you look around, and the mechanic is that if you see these special sparkles, you know, upon an object or something, you break out this lens, you do a little pattern puzzle to activate it, and then you get sort of like imagine like a YouTube movie, but you have the the little play slider, and you can manipulate the play slider, and you actually see the events of what happened with whatever specific area you're looking at. For example, you have to figure out how to access a hidden passageway. And there's an instance where you see the sparkles all over the ground in the wall. You whip it out, you do the pattern thing. And then the little time movie that you see is a guy walking up and manipulating something on the wall. So basically, you manipulate the camera in order to look at what the guy's playing with, and you can sit there and do it pretty much like frame by frame to watch exactly what he's doing. And then when you're done, you do the same thing, and voila. And they apply this to different situations and different puzzles and stuff. So, you know, once again,
like glimpsing through time.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty much it. And it's a very interesting way they do it. And like I said, it kind of gets added to your checklist, because eventually when you get to the later rooms, whenever I got stuck, it wasn't because I couldn't figure out a puzzle. Like I said, it's usually because there was some little, very inconspicuous item that I completely missed, you know, and this is, you know, this is kind of like up to the eye of the beholder, because sometimes, like, so I can see how people would complain that this might be the game's fault, but I can see how some people could say, well, it's the player's fault for having the attention span of a gnat. But it eventually gets to a point where it's like, you enter the room, wander around, play with everything you can play with, you know, look at it from every angle that's physically possible with the camera, look at it with each lens, poke at everything you could possibly poke at, look at everything that you could possibly look at, see if you can manipulate anything that looks like it's manipulatable. Because one of the interesting things about this puzzle game is that the cursor is not context sensitive, which is sort of a catch-22, because on one side, like, you don't know if something's, you know, if you can play with something until you just sit there and spam click it. So, but on the upside, it presents a challenge in that you don't, it's not one of those puzzle games where all you have to do is just wave the cursor around and the moment it changes into, like, you know, a grabby icon. Oh, well, that's what I have to play with. And you start poking at it. I mean, basically, you really have to scrutinize the shit out of a lot of things in order to figure out what is and isn't affectable.
So the cursor isn't just easy mode where if you can't figure out what you're doing, just highlight over everything until it changes.
Yeah. I mean, there are some instances where it will change, but it's not like it's a giveaway to a puzzle. It's like you obviously see that this is a lever to be pulled. You put your cursor on it, it turns into a grab hand. So you grab it and you pull it.
Yeah.
You know, so they're very practical about that. You know, like, and another thing that's, you have to kind of, that comes into play is that a lot of items you pick up that go into your inventory, you actually have to play around and manipulate them to transform, for lack of a better word, them into other objects. You know, like this big, huge, you know, this huge chunk of wood goes into your inventory and then you start playing with it and suddenly it turns into a hand crank. You know, other things aren't quite so obvious and you have to kind of figure out how they interact with other puzzles. And, you know, a lot, and the puzzle design, like I said, the puzzle design is really solid. When I'm streaming it, you know, I kind of have like a no backseat policy, but it was really hard for my viewers and not necessarily in a bad way to not just like venture out opinions and ideas. It's like, well, what if you do this? Well, what if you do that? Cause there were, like I said, there were a couple times where I got stuck and I'm just sitting there like probably spending like 10 to 15 minutes bouncing from station to station, poking and prodding things.
Oh yeah. I was there for a couple of those.
Yeah. And I think the only time that I really called bullshit on the game was that there was an instance where I played with something, nothing happened. One of my viewers say, well, that looks kind of odd. Why don't you try poking that? And I'm like, well, I already poked it once and nothing happened. So I went back and tried it again. And suddenly, you know, it slid away. Something was revealed. And that was like the one piece that pretty much let me clear through a huge chunk of the room. And I was kind of pissed off about it. You know, not necessarily because like, oh, they figured out something that I didn't, but it's like, you know, like I said, I already tried playing with that once and 10 minutes later, it's like, oh.
Hey, yeah. It happens to the best of us where you just got to keep playing with it until it does what you want it to do.
Yeah. And I think that kind of comes to the only con or negative thing that I have to say about the game is that there are some instances where you have to find, like, you know, an interactable field that's literally pixels wide.
Yeah.
You know, like, but there were a couple times where it's like, I know I have to play with something on this, but I can't tell exactly where it is. So I'm just sitting there just blasting my mouse buttons through the desk as I'm slowly migrating the cursor across, trying to find the handful of pixels that will let me do what I need to do.
Oh, boy. Well, it sounds like a fairly minor gripe in the grand scheme of things. So for $20 on this one, what do you think about it?
I would say if you're a really diehard, you know, diehard into puzzle games and stuff like that, I would give it a try it because the ending of the game itself leaves on a super crazy mega cliffhanger.
Mm.
But, I mean, if you have money burning in your pocket and you're looking for something to tie you down, you know, something to keep you busy for a very good chunk of time. I did get about like 9 hours out of it. And for what it had to offer, buy it. I mean, like I said, the only reason I'd say try it is like wait to see if the second part comes out so you can get the package deal.
No.
I very much enjoyed it. It was a very positive experience.
Sounds good. Well, Ian, thank you as always for coming on, chatting about this stuff. Do you have any final thoughts to sum it up?
No.
All right, moving on. Next game to talk about is called Prismata, developed and published by Lunark Studios. It released March 8th on Steam for $24.99. Competing against other humans or ruthlessly efficient AI, you'll plan devastating attacks through a series of quick-fire turns. Will you outwit your opponents by striking at the perfect moment, or will you fall victim to a devious trap? Guessing that you fell into a bunch of devious traps. Royal Sefton, you're here. How are you doing?
Oh, trying to get myself out of devious traps. So still got more ass than the bear has teeth, my friend.
What was that saying again?
I still got more ass than the bear has teeth.
Nice. So this is the game that you famously went through the toots last week.
Yes, I was doing the toots.
Did you get beyond the toots this week?
I did.
So what is this game?
Okay, so it's kind of like, it's a little bit of a genre bender, but it's a computerized card game and sort of a turn-based strategy game with resource management and a bit of a light combat sort of thing going on too. I don't really have a name for what it is.
I'm already confused.
Yes, and you know what? When I saw the video, I was like, you want me to play this? I don't even know if I know how to operate this. This looks complicated. This looks like work. But you know what? It's pretty slick. It's a real slick game.
So what are you doing it? Because I'm looking at this. It looks like a card game, but I know when I was first told about the game, I was pretty much told this is not a card game.
Right. It looks like a card game. That's sort of the rub. It's not really a card game at all. It's more like a turn-based strategy game that looks like a card game. So, yeah, what I mean by that is you generate these different resources, or, you know, they might be your defense. You generate walls and energy barriers or engineers that in turn generate a type of energy that you can apply to create other units. And each turn, you're accumulating these resources. Some will not carry over into the next round, and some you can stack between rounds, and then you spend these resources. You know, you got kind of like a money type resource. You've got this one that's a lightning bolt. You go. They have names for all these things. I don't remember any of the names. It's kind of convoluted, but you accumulate these resources. You spend them to create more units, which in turn create defense, offense, or more resources, and then you plot your attack by clicking on the stack. You can like shift click on a stack of these attackers, for example, and then it does a little sword icon, and it gets a count of how much damage you want to do. And then when you commit your turn, you get to pick where that damage goes. Well, your enemy gets to pick where that damage goes, I should say. Then it's their turn to attack, and you get to pick where that damage goes on your team. You can choose who your frontline defenders are. Unfortunately, once they breach your defenses, then they get to pick what units they're going to mess up. And in the end, the plan is, of course, to decimate every single unit they have on the board before they decimate yours.
Which is how it usually works in competitive games.
Right, of course. But it has to be total obliteration, you know, etc. But yeah, it's not really a card game. It just really looks like one. So I was confused when I first saw the video. I thought, okay, this looks really complicated. It looks like a card game, but you could have 60, 70 cards on there if you want. Well, that doesn't seem like a normal card game to me. And it isn't. It isn't. It's really a turn-based strategy game that uses cards to represent all these different resources. And as you can imagine, the strategic depth of this game, it's pretty involved. So it has a very active online community to go with it, ranked play. I haven't participated in that. I'm not good enough yet, not even close. My computer's still pretty good at kicking my butt sometimes because I'll be a little too hasty in terms of building up defense. I'll start skipping to offense a little too soon sometimes, and then I get my ass handed to me. So. Nice. Yeah, it's pretty rough for in terms of difficulty level if you're not thinking for it. I was never good at chess, so maybe that's kind of a sign that this isn't really the kind of game I'm going to excel at.
But you're still having fun with it, and that's the important part.
Yeah, I mean, if you look through the reviews that have already popped up on this game, and if I'm not mistaken, it's still in early access, isn't it? Yeah, it's an early access game. It Yep. seems like there's a real fervent amount of support for this game. A lot of players that just really strongly feel this is a solid game, and I agree with them. I can see why people get excited about it.
Hmm. Yeah, so, it's looking like it's in early access now. Their plan is to... says here, our current plans contain about 5 months worth of projects and features that we feel are necessary for the game to be considered, quote, complete.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know the game now is $25. Later in early access, they're actually going to release a light version that's going to be free to play with. Mm-hmm. And it says with substantially less single player content. So I know the Founders Edition has 5-episode single player story, it says. Something like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's kind of like a visual novel thing between each of the fights. So there's a story going along that you get to follow along with. No real branching that I've seen yet, but it's interesting. Kind of reminds me of like, I always make these untoward comparisons that aren't really that accurate, but it reminded me a little bit of like Phantasy Star, that universe. Yeah, so, I mean, the art style is a little different from that, but it's still that sort of like, you know, quasi-futuristic frontier sort of thing going on, yeah, as well as, of course, computers going haywire and what's really going on behind that.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. I have a lot of praise to sing for this game.
But what other praise can you heap upon it?
It looks really polished. They've been putting years of work into it, and it shows. You know, I'm not seeing typographical errors, much less anything that really sticks out as being particularly ugly or unrefined. Good music, good sound. The AI is smart. It's just a really solid game.
Do you have any gripes about it or any negatives? Because I'm not hearing any.
Well, like I said, I mean, I'm no damn good at chess. This is probably not everybody's cup of tea. If you're looking for something a little bit more fast-paced, a little more exciting, this isn't going to be real frantic. And, yeah, I mean, I really have to struggle to think of something negative to say about it, because I had a lot of fun playing it, and I'm going to continue to play it.
Nice. So, $25 on this one for the full Founders Edition of the game in Early Access. What are your thoughts on that? What is your verdict?
Oh, it's a buy it. I mean, the only reason it wouldn't be a buy it is, again, if this is sort of, if you'd rather spend your $25 on a first person shooter or a platformer, then it's just a matter of whether it's your cup of tea. If you're looking for, you know, a solid strategy game, I really think this has a lot to offer. I would put $25 on Prismata. Absolutely.
Nice. Sounds good. I might have to check this one out eventually, probably when it hits when the light version shows up, just because I don't know how my computer will handle it.
That's one of the things that's also really nice about it. It's actually fairly low resource, not real resource intensive. So yeah, it should play on. I'll check the spec sheet real quick, but yeah, they were saying basically there might be some performance reduction if your graphics chip is more than 12 years old.
Yeah, it says extremely old 2006 or earlier graphic chipsets may not support the hardware graphics acceleration used. In this case, the performance may be reduced. Not unplayable. It just might be reduced.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, pretty much any computer could play this at this point.
So I might definitely have to check this one out then. It sounds really, really cool. And since there's online play, we could lose to each other.
Exactly. That sounds like fun.
Oh, man. Well, Royal, always good having you on chatting about this stuff. Do you have any final thoughts to wrap it up?
Be sure to do the toots. It always pays to do the toots.
The friggin' toots. That's still funny.
Never gets old, man.
All right, moving on. Final game to talk about tonight. I know it's been a long one. One last game to talk about is called It's Spring Again, developed by Baba Yaga Games, published by Sometimes You, released April 17th on Nintendo Switch for $1.99. It's Spring Again, an educational game for children ages 2 and up. It uses game mechanics to teach children about the seasons. The game is intended to develop associational and logical thinking. By following the hints, children help the seasons change. They learn the order of the seasons and create a melody for each of them with a little help from their parents and the narrator. Checking this one out. Norg, how are you doing, buddy?
Fabulous. How are you?
I'm doing good. I hear that it wasn't just you that played this one, though, was it?
You are correct. But before we get to that, I've got to ask you something.
Okay.
What is it with you and all of the Russian indie developers getting their hands on you?
I don't know.
I think this is like the third or fourth game I've reviewed for you now where it was very obviously developed by someone from Russia. And it really struck me because when you introed it and you said it's Baba Yaga Games, Baba Yaga is a Russian folklore character. She's the woman who lives in the house on the chicken lakes. And she's terrifying. One of these days, you should look her up. It's like,
at least now I know I've been saying it wrong all these years.
Well, when I was growing up, that's how it was said, at least by the Russians around me. So yeah, look into that sometime. Was it Heroes Quest? The Sierra game. Do you remember playing Heroes Quest way back in the day?
I played either that or Quest for Glory, one of the two.
Right, yes, Quest for Glory. That was what the name changed to because Heroes Quest was the name of the board game that had the copyright. Quest for Glory 1. You remember the big bouncing purple Antwerp and everything?
Yeah.
There,
I think it was in that game, or it might have been one of the King's Quests. I'm getting it mixed up probably. But one of those games had a house on chicken legs, and the character inside the house on the chicken legs was Baba Yaga.
You are teaching me things today, and I don't know how to handle that.
I feel like such an instructor this evening. I feel like I have to put my glasses down over my nose in order to be able to continue to discuss these matters with you. Anyway.
Well, Papa Norgio, tell me.
Papa Norgio,
brother. Since you're about teaching people stuff today, it's good to talk about an educational game that you played with your child.
Yes, my three-year-old daughter, Hope, was my demo model for this game, and she dove into it with a fervor that I did not realize she was capable of. And I think part of it was the fact that it was the first time that she got to do anything with my Switch that was not watching me do something else or play steampunk tactical platformer games, which I'm still playing. But she had a ball most of the time with this game.
So what is this game?
This game is basically an endless cycle of the seasons. And the goal is to give kind of a broad overview of how the seasons work in our world. And it's perfect for a three-year-old, a four-year-old, a five-year-old, maybe even a six-year-old. Six-year-old might be pushed. I'm trying to think of my oldest daughter. If she had tried to play this a year ago, I think she would have liked it for a little bit, but she'd already be more familiar with how the seasons work and maybe possibly less interested. But I think the thing that would get her the same way it got Hope was the fact that the art style was extremely captivating. Everything had a personality. Every cloud had a face. The sun had a happy face. The trees had eyes. The earth had eyes, and if you touched the earth, it would try to cover its face. It was very cute. The art style was beautiful, and that absolutely drew Hope in. When now, for the record, I sat the Switch in front of her and I held it still for her, but she did everything. So this was completely driven by her three-year-old brain wanting to see what things did. And occasionally I would coach her and say, okay, well, why don't you try touching the trees and see what it does? Oh, my goodness, the trees did a thing. The flowers grew. The fruits grew. The fruits landed on the ground. And as each season went on, different things happened. It starts with pushing the rain clouds out of the way, which she very quickly figured out how to do to reveal the sun. And then the sun descends on the earth, and then the flowers grow and the trees grow. And then plants start to kind of die away because it's going into summer, and they get replaced with flowers, and there's fruits, and there's different creatures that walk the earth. And then it gets into fall, and all of the leaves fall off of the trees, and then the wind comes, and then the snow comes, and then there's the big storm that grows and grows and grows. And eventually, after winter, the snow melts, and lo and behold, it's spring again. And then the cycle starts again.
Oh, it's like the name of the game.
Amazing, isn't it?
It all clicks. It all just comes together.
Hope was not at all disturbed by the fact that she had already gone through it, because it was the level of familiarity for her. So she already knew that she needed to move the clouds, and she already knew that she needed to touch on the trees to get the trees to do things. And she knew that if she touched the creature, it would make a funny sound, or the earth would try to hide her face. So she was totally digging it. The narration was fantastic and absolutely crucial and extremely well done. The sound effects were all appropriate. The overall environment, the feel of each of the seasons was distinct. And it was really fun to watch two things. One, just the game itself and the art style and how it felt overall. But then especially was fun, and I'm sure that it's intentional, is watching my kid just get completely captivated by this thing. and it's like going to Disneyland and letting your daughter meet Elsa and Anna from Frozen for the first time after waiting in line for 2 hours, and you realize that even though it's an extremely clean room, it's very dusty in there for some reason, because your kid is just so overwhelmed and excited, and there's Elsa and Anna in real life, and there are you as the parent watching her just be so excited and so happy. And And obviously there's a huge market out there for doing things for parents, for kids, if you want to describe it that way. But yeah, it ended extremely well for Hope as an experience for her getting to do a thing on a screen that was different than some of the things that she has available to herself on a tablet, which we ended up getting because we had to get the older one a tablet. And so we got the younger one a tablet because we're sheep. But so let me quickly go through a couple of things that stood out that were not as great about the game.
All right.
There were a couple of bugs, and I had to work real hard to think about things that were not okay about the game, because overall it was a fantastic experience. But during one of the seasons, the leaves on the trees would not finish changing colors. And I think I even sent you a video of that happening. And what ended up happening was when it didn't work immediately, 3-year-old brain is like, I'm done. Or worse, it's broken, Daddy. So,
and just and peace on out.
Yeah, she just, I'm out of here. And she wanted to go do something else. So I made her come back and I tapped around, and I showed you in the video, I kept tapping in the places where it was supposed to work and it wasn't working. And eventually I just mad dash tapped all around the screen, and eventually it triggered a point where it made it work, and then it continued on playing. So that was only a minor setback. The other thing that happened was after the second playthrough where the title comes back on and it says it's spring again, the first time we played through, it just continued on and the clouds come up and you have to move the clouds and you have to reveal the sun. After the second playthrough, it just froze there and it would not allow any proceeding further. So again, that was another peace out moment. But that at that point, she's like, I'm done. And that's when we ended up with extra commentary that you're going to play in a couple of minutes. But those were the only two things that cropped up that marred what I felt was otherwise a fantastic educational experience for young children, older toddlers, preschool aged kids. But don't take my word for it. You've got
something
pretty
cool. Whose word should we take for it, George?
Why don't we take the words directly from my daughter's mouth after my wife interviewed her?
So, take it away.
Hopi, what do you think of that game?
This?
Yeah, do you like it? Did you like that game?
Yeah.
Would you like to play it again?
Yes.
Do you have anything to say to Mr. Jokam?
I have some games for you on my tablet.
Oh, on your tablet?
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
So I can play my tablet.
How many thumbs up for this game? Two thumbs or one thumb?
One thumb.
One thumb. Okay.
So one thumb up. That sounds pretty good for a 3-year-old.
For a 3-year-old to even get one thumb up is fantastic, because usually it's a finger in the nose.
I was going to make a booger joke and you beat me to it.
I'm always going to beat you to the booger joke because I see it every day.
Awful minds think alike.
No kidding.
So Hope gives it a thumbs up. What do you give it?
I would say if you have a preschool aged child in your house, it is absolutely worth having for a couple of reasons. One, it gives you a chance to watch your kid do something pretty cool while learning about the seasons. And two, and especially in the case of the Switch, it takes the mystery of this device that you pretty much are using exclusively, and it puts it in her hands, and that makes that makes your child feel awesome, because now all of a sudden it's, I'm using mommy and daddy's thing and I'm doing it, and it's so cool. So there's definitely the cool factor of using what is typically exclusively the parent's device. So I would definitely say buy this if you have a toddler aged or preschool aged child in the house.
Yeah, I know the Nintendo page online says it's basically recommended ages 2 through 5. So that pretty much covers it.
Absolutely. So that's like preschool through kindergarten, couple of years of preschool.
And best of all, that price tag.
I didn't actually see what the price tag was. How much is it?
$1.99.
No way.
Yep.
Get it. Absolutely get it. For $1.99, you absolutely cannot go wrong with this one.
Sounds good. George, it is always wonderful having you on the show. I've noticed you're a little less animated than usual. What's going on?
Well, I'm reviewing a kid's game, and it's hard to get as nuts about a kid's game, one. And two, wouldn't it be nice if my child could actually listen to this segment without saying, "Daddy, why did you say those things?"
So go figure. We just had a solid 15 minutes of no profane language, and it felt weird. I don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do. So
I think we might have to kibitz about this afterwards.
So I think the only thing left to do is ask for final words. And those final words are, George, how many boogers are on your Switch now?
At least 7.
Two thumbs or one thumb?
One thumb.
One thumb. Okay.